Welcome to the Federal Society's Practice Group Podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federal Society's Administrative Law, Civil Rights, Federalism, and Litigation Practice Groups, was recorded on Wednesday, March 14, 2018, during a live teleform conference call held exclusively for Federal Society members. Welcome to the Federal Society's teleform conference call. This afternoon's topic is the 20-state lawsuit challenging Obamacare's constitutionality. My name is Wesley Hodges, and I'm the Associate Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Today, we are happy to have with us Professor Jonathan Adler, who is the Johann Verheyen Memorial Professor of Law and Director of the Center for Business Law and Regulation at Case Western Reserve University School of Law. Also with us today is Misha Saitlin, who is the Solicitor General for the State of Wisconsin. After our speaker's remarks, we'll open for an audience Q&A. So as this call goes on, please keep note of any questions you have for our speakers. We'll have plenty of time at the end for your questions. Thank you for speaking with us. Misha, the floor is yours to begin.
Thank you so much, and thank you for the Federalist Society for hosting this and for Professor Adler for participating. I think in understanding our lawsuit and our legal issues here, I think background is key, since in the state's view, this lawsuit is just a logical conclusion of the NFIB versus Sebelius litigation, and it follows not, and the relief we're asking for follows naturally from the logic of that decision and the follow-on changes to the ACA that Congress enacted in 2017. So in order for our lawsuit in this context to make sense, I'd first like to talk about the Affordable Care Act as originally enacted. And I'm talking about the Affordable Care Act here as originally enacted. I'm only going to be talking about the best understanding of the ACA's text without the Chief Justice's avoidance reading with regard to the tax power. And I think that's appropriate because, as I will show a little later in this call, the avoidance reading is now irrelevant because the avoidance reading was based upon a certain tax interpretation of the ACA, which is no longer available to the courts. So again, I think only the best interpretation of the statutory text, as the dissent and Chief Justice Roberts' separate opinion acknowledged, is what's relevant. Now, under that reading of the ACA statutory text, the ACA has a standalone individual mandate. It provides that an applicable individual shall ensure that the individual is covered with minimal essential coverage. This is a standalone requirement separate from the tax penalty that applies to some, that originally, under the original ACA, applied to some, but not all, to whom the mandate applies. And the separation between those to whom the mandate originally applied and those to whom the mandate applied but didn't have to pay a tax penalty, and I think is quite telling. Those who are religious objectors, illegal immigrants, and prisoners are not subject to the individual mandate at all. They don't have to get affordable, quote-unquote, affordable coverage under the ACA. They can be uninsured. On the other hand, there's people who are poor folks who are still subject to the mandate. That means they would be violating the law if they didn't obtain minimum essential coverage, generally through Medicaid. And then I'm talking more about original Medicaid than the expanded Medicaid under the ACA. But they are not subject to, they were not under the original ACA subject to any tax penalty. And I think the reason for that was that Congress decided, while we want to force those people to get health insurance, it would be really unfair to penalize them money-wise if they're not going to do so because they're already poor and we don't want to have a mandate on them and also cause them to be out of pocket a bunch of money. So when Congress originally enacted the individual mandate and this penalty, it actually had specific findings in the text of the law, and this will be very critical to the discussion of our lawsuit. And the specific finding said that the requirement, the individual mandate, is essential to the ACA's health insurance market reforms. It's important to note that the text of the ACA there refers to the requirement, the individual mandate, not the separate tax penalty. So Congress in the ACA specifically and by the text of the law found that the mandate, not the penalty, was essential to those market insurance reforms. And in fact, the Obama administration during the NFIB versus Sebelius litigation treated that statutory finding in the text of the law as functionally a text-based inseparability clause, such that the Obama administration conceded that if the individual mandate were declared unconstitutional, then at least some aspects of the ACA, guaranteed issue and community rating, would need to be declared unconstitutional based upon that provision, which, again, the Obama administration treated as a text-based inseverability clause. And the Supreme Court, in a follow-on case in King versus Burwell, understood it the same way. The court said the guaranteed issue and community ratings requirements would not work without the coverage requirement. Now, in NFIB versus Sebelius, a majority of the Supreme Court, which is the Chief Justice and the four dissenting justices, Scalia, Kennedy, Thomas, Alito, agreed with the state's arguments that the individual mandate, standing alone, exceeds Congress's power under the Commerce Clause. But the same majority of the court also agreed that what I just gave as the account of the best reading of the individual mandate as a standalone requirement that everyone except for religious objectors, prisoners, and illegal immigrants obtain coverage is the best reading of the ACA. However, a different majority, this one composed of the Chief Justice and Justices Ginsburg, Breyer, Sotomayor, and Kagan, said it was fairly possible to read the mandate and the tax penalty as one provision, as a matter of constitutional avoidance, and that it upheld, and then that majority of the court upheld the individual mandate, now combined with the tax penalty, as constitutional under Congress's tax power. But it is important to note that the majority said that an essential feature of that tax holding was that this newly combined tax penalty and mandate produces at least some revenue, and it cited cases going back to the 1950s and before for that some revenue requirement. So the next step in this train is the Tax Cuts and Job Act of 2017. And what that act did was something very small and but very simple. What it did was it eliminated the tax penalty, but it did not eliminate the mandate. And the CBO report, which is pretty much the legislative history we have on this Tax Cut Act of 2017, said this. It said this eliminates the mandate, it eliminates the penalty, but it doesn't eliminate the mandate. So what follows from this? Well, I think what obviously follows from this is that the avoidance reading that the Chief Justice adopted in NFIB Sebelius is no longer possible. So now we're back to the world in NFIB versus Sebelius, where if the tax the avoidance reading was not available. So in light of this, the states, 20 states, brought a lawsuit in federal district court in Texas saying courts complete the work of NFIB Sebelius since the avoidance reading is no longer possible. And here, with regard to our lawsuit, I would like to talk about three things. One, the merits of our argument. Two, severability. And three, standing. First, with regard to the merits of our argument, I think this issue is quite straightforward and follows naturally from the opinions of the Chief Justice and the dissenting justices in NFIB versus Sebelius. There are two bases on which the federal government attempted to justify the individual mandate in NFIB versus Sebelius, one under the Commerce Clause and one under the taxing power. Now, with regard to the Commerce Clause, there was very hot dispute between the federal government and its supporters and the states and those that agreed with us, including the NFIB, about whether Congress had the authority to mandate people buy health insurance under the Commerce Clause. That's clearly what Congress thought it was doing. The Chief Justice even acknowledged that in his opinion. And what the Chief Justice and the four dissenters said is, no, Congress does not have the authority to mandate people buy health insurance. And this, of course, would strike down the mandate if there was no other constitutional basis for it. Now, in NFIB, famously, the Chief Justice, as a matter of constitutional avoidance, said, well, if you combine the mandate with the tax penalty, then you can uphold this under tax power. And that's, that argument can be debated, but there's no reason to litigate that here. Because as the Supreme Court said in NFIB, the essential feature of a tax is it raises some revenue, and that has to be true. And the reason for that is the constitutional power to raise revenue, the Constitution says, is to provide for the common defense and general welfare. If a provision doesn't raise a penny of revenue, which the individual mandate's associated tax penalty now doesn't do in light of the zeroing out of the tax penalty by the Tax Cut Act, it clearly doesn't raise any funds for the general defense or welfare. So I think that just takes the tax avoidance reading off the table. All that is left is the Commerce Clause power, and a majority of the Supreme Court has already held that the individual mandate cannot be upheld under the Commerce Clause. Now, with regard to the issue of severability, when the Supreme Court had the NFIB versus Sebelius decision, they actually ordered a full set of separate briefing on severability, and there were three positions taken in that case. One was the one taken by the states, which is full invalidation of the ACA is required under a severability analysis because the individual mandate is the heart of the ACA. And there, the states very clearly in our briefs, we were talking about the essential coverage provision, not the tax penalty. We even pointed out that one of the most important parts of the individual mandate from Congress' design was to encourage poor folks to sign up for Medicaid so they would be covered. Under the original ACA, poor folks were not subject to the penalty at all. So the state's argument was that the individual mandate, once it is declared unconstitutional, would take down the rest of the ACA. And, of course, the four dissenters in FIB agreed with that interpretation, with that argument. There was the position taken by the federal government, which was that if the individual mandate was declared unconstitutional, then what would need to go is guaranteed issue and community rating. Basically, what guaranteed issue and community rating are is the requirement that insurance companies provide coverage to those with pre-existing conditions and that they not charge more to folks who are sick or old or things of that sort. And basically, what the Obama administration argued was, whatever else you think about inseparability, we have in that legislative finding that I mentioned earlier in my discussion, a text-based inseparability clause. And as a matter of statutory text, that means at least those only those provisions need to go. And the final argument, which was the most limited argument, was done by an amicus brief appointed by the U.S. Supreme Court, which argued that the individual mandate isn't essential to the rest of the law. You can sever off the individual mandate, and you can keep the rest of the law. And that was also the position that the 11th Circuit had taken in one of the iterations of the case that led to NFIB versus Sebelius. Now, in the state's view, the dissent was correct in NFIB, and the individual mandate is the heart of the ACA. It remains the heart of the ACA, as shown by the statutory findings in the ACA, which are text-based, and the whole law needs to be invalidated for the same reason that the dissenters gave. And again, I think it's also important that the dissenters did not highlight or point to the importance of the penalty aspect of the mandate. They were really talking about the requirement that all individuals that are not illegal immigrants or in prison or things of that sort obtain health insurance. But I do think that at minimum, one would have to be more protective of the ACA than the Obama administration was and less committed to the statutory text to say that at least guaranteed issue and community rating could survive the invalidation of the individual mandate. And finally, a small point on standing. The CBO itself found that at least some individuals would continue to obtain health insurance because of the mandate, regardless of the penalty. Those individuals are generally going to be the poor ones, and those people get their insurance through Medicaid. And Medicaid, the kind of the traditional Medicaid, not the Medicaid expansion, states kick in a portion of that. So the states suffer a traditional pecuniary harm as a result of the individual mandate. So I think the states clearly have standing on that basis, along with a couple of other bases for standing that we referenced in our complaint. I will say that our case now is in the preliminary stages. We just filed our complaint less than a month ago, and we are in Texas District Court, and you know the case will proceed in the usual course. And thank you.
All righty. First, thanks for the Federalist Society for organizing this call. It's a pleasure to be here and to discuss this case with Misha today. Let me start with the one area of agreement that I think we have, and that is that I think it is pretty clear under the Supreme Court's decision in NFIB, as well as from first principles and thinking about enumerated powers, that the individual mandate exceeds the scope of federal power, and that there are other aspects of the Affordable Care Act which certainly are problematic as a policy matter, and that may have effects on states and on insurance markets within states that it is understandable that states object to and would like to see changed. That, however, is where our agreement ends with regard to this suit. I am quite skeptical of this lawsuit, both as a matter of justiciability as well as the ultimate substantive claim that I think the lawsuit is aiming at. And so let me briefly walk through the basis for my skepticism and then happy to have some back and forth and take questions and the like. So first on standing, I do think that there are questions about whether or not states have standing to challenge the individual mandate in the statute. And I think that's true for two reasons. First is that the mandate by its terms does not impose obligations on states. It only purports to impose an obligation on applicable individuals. And when a state in the past has tried to challenge the mandate on its own, as Virginia sought to do, the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Fourth Circuit found that Virginia lacked standing to sue on its own behalf against the mandate, and I think that was a correct decision. I also think states have a standing problem because whatever other harms states may suffer from various aspects of the Affordable Care Act, I think it is difficult to argue that the existence of a mandate that is unenforced and unenforceable, that is a declaratory statement that there is an obligation that some individuals have, that there is no penalty for violating, imposes a justiciable injury sufficient to support standing under Article 3. And I think that is a reason why I would not be at all surprised were this case to fail at the standing stage, if not at the district court, then at the Court of Appeals. But what happens if I'm wrong on standing? Let's talk about what happens in terms of the substance of this suit. I think if there were standing, at least if there were injury for standing, the only thing that I think that the states can hope for in this case is a declaratory judgment that Congress lacks the power under the Commerce and Necessary and Proper Clauses to require or purport to require individuals to purchase a good or service from a private company. And therefore, this declaratory judgment would simply say that the mandate that Congress has chosen not to enforce is in fact unenforceable unless and until Congress elects to reimpose or reutilize a tax mechanism for purposes of enforcing the mandate. Let's set aside whether or not such a declaratory judgment will provide any redressability for standing purposes. I just flag that to note that it is another problem for standing in this case is whether or not the harms that the states claim are redressable. But I think that sort of declaratory judgment, which is in effect a restatement of the Supreme Court's Commerce Clause holding in NFIB, is really the most that can be hoped for. I don't think that this constitutional violation, this constitutional infirmity in the one provision of the ACA that's still on the books that purports to require individuals to purchase qualifying insurance is something that can be leveraged to get at other parts of the Affordable Care Act. And I think that there are problems with trying to leverage this constitutional infirmity. These problems come in two forms, both relating to questions of severability. The first, just as a narrow matter, in NFIB, a majority of the Supreme Court determined what the remedy was for a constitutional violation. In addressing what to do about the Medicaid provisions of the Act, when the Supreme Court, a majority of the Supreme Court, held that the Medicaid expansion represented an unconstitutional effort to coerce the states that exceeded the scope of the federal government's spending powers and was an impermissible use of conditional spending, Chief Justice Roberts explained that merely rendering that requirement unenforceable was fully sufficient to remedy the alleged constitutional violation, and there was no need to do anything else, and nothing else in the Act was called into question by that. So in terms of what the Supreme Court has already said about severability under NFIB, the Supreme Court has already indicated that if there is a provision that is unenforceable, it is sufficient to simply hold that that is unenforceable, and there is no need to raise questions about the rest of the Act. I would note that this is not a one-off in the current court. under Chief Justice Roberts, the Supreme Court's approach to severability generally has been incredibly minimalist in this way. In cases like Free Enterprise Fund and other cases in which the court has been asked to strike down unconstitutional provisions of statutes, where the court has been unable to find a saving construction and has been felt the need to invalidate portions of federal law for exceeding the scope of federal power, the traditional approach this court has adopted is simply to surgically remove the constitutional infirmity or to declare that a particular provision is unenforceable and to leave the rest of the statute in question in place. And I see no reason to suspect that the current court would adopt a different approach. I would note that this approach to severability may be doctrinally unsatisfying. It may be at odds with what a more principled severability jurisprudence might look like, but it is entirely consistent with what we've seen from the court in recent years and the way the severability doctrine has evolved over the past few decades. The more fundamental problem with this, with the underlying severability claim in this case is that severability for a long time has been based on legislative intent. That is, the question the court tries to answer is, what would Congress have done if the constitutionally infirm provision of the act could not have been adopted? It would be easy and simple, and Misha and I might agree that it might be more desirable for the court to simply follow the explicit textual instructions that Congress provides on this question and to only find severability where Congress has expressly said that provision should be severable. I'm very sympathetic to that view, but that is not the severability doctrine we have. That is not the approach to severability the Supreme Court has adopted in recent years, indeed for quite some time. Instead, what the court looks at is whether or not the statute in question can continue to operate without the provision in question. And here, and this I think is the key point, the Affordable Care Act, as it exists today, exists in a form that is different than that which was enacted in 2010, that is different from what the court considered NFIB versus Sebelius. And any question about the severability of this unenforceable mandate from the rest of the statute has to be looked at in terms of the Affordable Care Act as it exists today. Congress, in eliminating the tax penalty for the failure to purchase qualifying insurance, has made the judgment that an Affordable Care Act without enforcement of the mandate is preferable to one with an enforced mandate. This is not the first time a legislature has made this sort of choice. Prior to the Affordable Care Act, there were multiple states that enacted equivalent insurance reforms, guaranteed issue, community rating, and the like, without imposing any sort of mandate for the purchase of insurance. This sort of policy produces very predictable effects on insurance markets, but there is nothing that says legislatures are precluded from making this choice. It may be unwise, but it's not the basis for throwing out the entire law. When Congress was considering zeroing out the tax penalty for the mandate, the Congressional Budget Office analyzed this and said that it would result in a reduction in coverage, largely because individuals would find it easier to refuse to purchase insurance than they had before, and Congress chose to do it anyway. Congress chose to have an Affordable Care Act on the books that has a mandate that does not perform the same function to the same degree that Congress had sought in 2010. That's another way of saying that the Affordable Care Act today is not the Affordable Care Act of 2010. The findings that were made about the 2010 law cannot be read as binding instructions to courts about the Affordable Care Act today. There's no precedent for viewing findings that way, and indeed, it would be a distortion of the court's relationship to Congress if courts were to second-guess how Congress decides to go about amending and revising portions of the U.S. Code in this way. Congress has decided that, just as Congress has decided the Affordable Care Act should exist without the Independent Payment Advisory Board, which Congress has eliminated, just as Congress has decided that the Affordable Care Act should operate without cost-sharing reduction payments to insurance companies, as Congress has decided, Congress has decided that a less effective, less punitive, unenforceable mandate is what should be in the Affordable Care Act, and that the consequences of having this in conjunction with various insurance market reforms is preferable than the alternative. That is the Affordable Care Act that a reviewing court has to analyze, and there is no basis whatsoever for a court to conclude that because Congress made that choice, portions of the act that Congress opted not to revise and not to change, let alone to repeal, must somehow be invalidated as somehow being inseparable from the rest of the act. I think concluding otherwise kind of is an attempt to leverage a small constitutional infirmity in one portion of the act to get at changes to the Affordable Care Act that Congress was unable to adopt, and I think is a misapplication of the way we typically think about severability, and one that would have quite disturbing implications for the ability of the legislature going forward to make revisions to existing laws on the books in light of the preferences of current congressional majorities. So for these reasons, I think that this suit has standing problems, but I think more fundamentally has problems in terms of the sort of remedy that it's seeking. We can agree that a naked mandate that tells individuals to purchase insurance from private companies is beyond the scope of the federal government's enumerated powers. But beyond that, I don't see anything in the suit that can or should change the way the Affordable Care Act operates going forward. Thank you, and I look forward to questions and comments.
Thank you, Professor. Misha, do you have a response, or would you like to open to audience Q&A?
I've got a response, if you don't mind, a couple minutes.
Please do. Thank you.
All right, first, I'm glad. Thank you, Professor Adler, for those very thoughtful remarks. I'm glad we have agreement on the merits of our lawsuit. I think that the merits of our lawsuit would achieve important objectives, since the Supreme Court's avoidance reading was only an avoidance reading. The individual mandate is still currently on the books, and it's currently the law of the United States, because the Supreme Court did not declare the individual mandate unconstitutional. Now, quickly, with regard to standing, Virginia based this lawsuit in the Fourth Circuit upon a Virginia-specific nullification statute. The Fourth Circuit's holding was limited to the fact that that nullification statute did not grant standing. Many states sued in the 11th Circuit, including Wisconsin, were not based on the nullification statute, and we had standing all the way up to the U.S. Supreme Court. So I don't think that the Fourth Circuit precedent is troubling to the states. I also think that the reason that the states in the 11th Circuit clearly had standing is the same reason that we currently have standing, is that the individual mandate causes folks to sign up to Medicaid, which causes the state's classical traditional pocketbook harm. And I think there's clear redressability. The CBO said that the individual mandate without the penalty is going to cause at least some folks to sign up. When folks sign up for Medicaid, that costs the states money. As courts have famously held, even $1 of harm is enough for standing. The states have certainly more than $1 of harm as a result of our Medicaid obligations. Now, I think the real kind of meaty issue in this case is severability. And I'll first start with, I think, the sole point agreement on severability, and then I will talk about a disagreement, which is that the Roberts Court has been fairly pro-severability in cases, including the PCOB case, which I think is a major point in Professor Adler's directions in his favor. But I think there's several primary reasons where I think I think the court may well take a different view in this case. And first, to respond to the Medicaid provision point that Professor Adler made, which is that the Supreme Court severed off the unconstitutional aspects of the Medicaid provision of Obamacare and kept the rest of the law intact. I think it's very important to note that the court there specifically referenced a severability clause in the Medicaid statute, and it relied upon that severability clause to sever off that portion. So I think whatever the Supreme Court said about Medicaid provision on severability doesn't doesn't really carry a lot of weight in other aspects when there is no severability clause. And in fact, and this leads to my second and much more important point, when there is a what even the Obama administration conceded was an inseverability clause or a functional inseverability clause in the legislative findings. Professor Adler is, of course, correct that severability is a matter of legislative intent. And the reason that severability analysis is usually so loosey-goosey is usually you will not have a legislative finding of severability or inseverability. Now, in the Medicaid statute, you had a specific severability clause, so it was quite straightforward to sever off. But what we have here is quite the opposite. As even the Obama administration conceded, we have a text-based inseverability clause. And again, severability is a matter of legislative intent. And the clearest way, and if you do the hierarchy of ways to figure out legislative intent, the top way to figure out legislative intent is statutory text. And this is, I think goes to the heart of my most important disagreement with Professor Adler. The Affordable Care Act, as it stands today, contains those legislative findings, which even the Obama administration conceded were a text-based inseverability clause. I would agree entirely with Professor Adler on severability if Congress had, in the 2017 tax law, along with deleting the tax penalty, also deleted that inseverability clause. But Congress specifically did not do so. What Professor Adler's position would require would be some sort of implicit repeal of that clause, which remains in the statutory text, which I think is beyond what the Supreme Court has been willing to do with statutory text. This court has a lot of ideological divisions. But I think, as Justice Kagan said in her confirmation hearings, or maybe it was before confirmation hearings or after it was, we're all textualists now. And where you have statutory text that says that the individual mandate, which is still in the law, is inseverable from at least certain portions of the law, it is unfaithful to legislative intent as determined by the statutory text, which again is the top way to interpret legislative intent, not to sever off those portions, not to invalidate those portions as an instantiation of legislative intent. The kind of intuition-based argument that, well, Congress in this Tax Cut Act got rid of the mandate and now got rid of the tax penalty, now the mandate is less enforceable, and therefore it would have wanted the rest of the law survives, I think might be the kind of inquiry that would be necessary if there was no severability or inseverability language in the text of the law. But given that we do have specific language in the law, I think that kind of inquiry is unnecessary and, in fact, quite inappropriate and a violation of the separation of powers, as articulated by Justice Scalia's justifications for textualism.
Thank you, Misha. Professor Adler, would you like to comment?
Yeah, maybe we go very briefly. First, on the question of standing, I think it's worth remembering that in the 11th Circuit, standing was based on that case on the fact that there were individual and private plaintiffs in that case, and the court in the 11th Circuit explicitly said that it didn't have to address the question of state standing because you only need one plaintiff with standing. So we don't have so the 11th Circuit decision allowing that the litigation to go forward, I don't think helps the standing claim here. I agree that there is a claim that can be made that states suffer a pecuniary harm when individuals who are already eligible for Medicaid but who have not signed up for Medicaid sign up as a result of federal action. I think making that a justiciable injury in this sort of context is difficult. Let's just say, for example, a government official in some way that was unauthorized made public statements that had the effect of inducing people who were eligible for Medicaid to sign up. Sure, that would result in additional state expenditures. I don't think that sort of thing could be a subject of federal litigation or would be sufficient for standing. It's certainly possible that the mere existence of the Affordable Care Act, the mere existence of information about the mandate could certainly continue to encourage people to sign up who might not have signed up before. And I don't think that that's enough to satisfy the requirements of Article III standing. But on the other hand, as we know, since Massachusetts versus EPA, courts have become much more permissive with standing claims brought by states, not always in the most consistent or principled way, but certainly that is a trend in the courts. So perhaps courts would find standing here. On the question of severability, just very quickly, the Obama administration did make an argument about functional inseverability based on the law that Congress enacted in 2010. Congress enacted a law that had a functional, enforceable mandate adopted in tandem with certain insurance market reforms. That was the choice that Congress made, and certainly based on that, there is a strong argument that Congress wanted those provisions to stand or fall together because they were enacted together. And they were also supported by other provisions of the Act, such as various tax credits and cost-sharing reductions and subsidies that are further designed to make insurance more affordable. Congress has since changed those provisions in many different ways. It has refused to fund the cost-sharing reductions at the cost that the Act anticipates. It has eliminated some of the cost-control provisions like the individual the IPAB. It has, as relevant here, made the mandate unenforceable. So any severability analysis we do today cannot be based on the trade-offs that Congress was making in 2010, because those are not the trade-offs that Congress has made since. Congress has revised the law. I understand the fact that the findings are still on the books, but findings are not dispositive and have never been held to be dispositive. In fact, courts do not view findings as the sort of thing that should trump clear statutory text, King versus Burwell notwithstanding. We recognize that the opera provisions of the law are what courts are bound by and must enforce and must pay attention to. And the fact that when the architecture of something like the Affordable Care Act was first enacted, that Congress adopted some set of findings in no way requires courts to review to view amended statutes in the same way. It is common for Congress to amend statutes without going back and amending the findings, and it would really make a mess of what Congress tries to do in such situations if we were to evaluate Congress's subsequent revisions in light of prior findings that had been adopted by a prior Congress about a statutory framework that reflected different trade-offs. I think we could agree that it would be better if courts consistently applied severability analysis in line with Congress's instructions and only found statutes severable where Congress told them to. I think we could agree that would provide for greater consistency and predictability in the law, but the court has not done that in decades, and this is not the case for the court to start trying to reinvigorate that approach to severability. I will stop there, and I look forward to people's questions.
Thank you, Professor. Let's go ahead and move to the audience Q&A. In a moment, you'll hear a prompt indicating that the floor mode has been turned on. After that, to request the floor, enter the star key and then the pound key. When we get to your request, you will hear a prompt, and then you may ask your question. We'll answer all questions in the order in which they are received. Again, if you'd like to ask a question for our speakers, enter the star key and then the pound key on your telephone. Oh, it looks like we do have one question coming up. Let's go ahead and move to our first caller.
Mr. Solicitor General, my name is Chris Land, and I'm an attorney. I just have a quick question about whether you have any indication that the Justice Department will actually defend this suit, or whether you foresee a coalition of states attempting to intervene and defending the suit in the way we've seen some of the other cases go forth in the last couple months. Thank you.
Thank you for that question. I have no indication of that. We are proceeding in this case like we would in any other. We're litigating against the federal government. The Affordable Care Act is the law of the land, and we are proceeding in terms of the adversarial posture. I would hope that even if this was still the Obama administration, they would stick to the text-based severability analysis at minimum that they voiced to the U.S. Supreme Court. I think it would be quite an extraordinary for this Justice Department to take a more pro-Obamacare, more pro-severability approach than the prior administration. But again, I have no indication of what they will do, and we shall all find out together, I presume.
Thank you for your question. I know we let Professor Adler have last word for that discussion a couple of minutes ago. Misha, is there anything that you'd like to comment on next.
Yeah, I mean, I'll just say kind of two quick things. One on standing. I think it's kind of downplaying what the individual mandate requires to say that it's comparable to some statement by some government officials. It is the law of the land in the United States of America that you have to have insurance, health insurance, Obamacare health insurance, unless you're an illegal immigrant, you're a religious objector, or you're in prison. That is the law of the land. And more, and as far as the CBO is concerned, at least some people will follow that law of the land and will get health insurance, not because of some statement by some government officials, but because of the law of the land enacted by Congress. Since it's undisputed, I think, and it will be undisputed, I would hope, that if any of those people are complying with the law of the land via Medicaid, the states will suffer pocketbook injury. The state should have standing on that basis. Now, with regard to severability, I will just say that as a matter of separation of powers, I think if Congress enacts what, you know, in the prior litigation was conceded was a non-severability clause, and a later Congress wants to change the law in some way, but no longer wants the non-severability clause to apply, it is incumbent upon Congress to delete the non-severability clause. It would be, I think, courts rewriting statutes to engage in litigation by just deleting that clause and trying to look and try to hypothesize what did Congress in 2017 really want. Were they just, as I believe, just enacting a tax cut act without thinking about severability? Or did they actually think, I would rather have an Obamacare that has these features but not that feature? I think rather than getting into that kind of metaphysical or psychological dispute about what individual congressmen would have wanted, we should just look at the statutory text. And the statutory text on this point is exactly the same as it was before. And it's that the individual mandate is essential to the operation of certain other provisions of the ACA.
Thank you for that response. Looks like we do have one question in the queue. We have plenty of time on the call. If anyone else would like to dial a question, just enter the star key and then the pound key. Let's go ahead and move to our next caller.
Hi, I had a question about how the litigation is structured in anticipation of the Supreme Court hearing the case. Obviously, there were already four votes for the Commerce Clause issue in NFIB, and some suspect that Chief Justice Roberts was persuaded more by institutional legitimacy concerns than by legal arguments. To the extent that you've, you know, allowed that thought to cross your mind in this litigation, how are you accounting for it? And is there a strategy to pick up that fifth vote when the Supreme Court, or if the Supreme Court hears the case?
I mean, obviously, you know, justices are, you know, are human beings, and you know there are various people who have speculations as to what drove Chief Justice Roberts' vote in NFIB. What drove Chief Justice's and Justice Kennedy's votes in King versus Burwell, which is obviously a case that Professor Adler knows quite a lot about. You know, the Supreme Court decision on this case is a long ways away. You know, obviously, you know, since the court had the NFIB case, Justice Gorsuch has replaced Justice Scalia. We don't know what the court personnel are going to be when this case ultimately reaches the Supreme Court, you know, 2, 3, 4 years down the line. So I think the best the states can do is just make the legal arguments. And again, I think the legal arguments that we're going to make, they don't allow for a lot of wiggle room because they're pretty simple. You know, on the merits, NFIB already paves the way for us. They say there's already a holding on Commerce Clause. The tax avoidance reading, I think, is no longer available. And on severability, I think the ground is already well trodden. We have, you heard a strong presentation from Professor Adler, which is, I think, what we'll hear from the defenders of the Affordable Care Act. We have the full non-severability analysis, which the dissenters in NFIB fully laid out, and the argument already been fully fleshed out by, you know, some of the brightest legal minds in the world, which is the dissenting justice in NFIB. There's also that middle ground position that the Obama administration articulated based upon the text-based severability clause. So, and there might be some other kind of gradations, but kind of we are in kind of well-trodden realm on almost all of these issues. And even the standing issue, that was already fully briefed out in the 11th Circuit in in the last case, even though, as Professor Adler said, it wasn't reached in the 11th Circuit. So all these things are kind of laid out, and we're going to make our best arguments. I'm sure that the opponents, our opponents, will make the best arguments and what the justices decide, whether it's justices that are currently composed of the Supreme Court or if there's a change in court personnel, will be up to them. We're just advocates. That's the best we can do.
If I could jump in there, just a couple quick points. One is I don't think that it's really fair to say that the courts are somehow bound by this functional non-severability clause because of these findings. Courts generally do not require Congress to adopt any findings whatsoever. That's not required when Congress enacts a law. When Congress enacts laws where the findings don't accurately describe what the law does, courts traditionally, and I would argue properly, follow the operative provisions of the law, even if that contradicts the stated findings. And courts have never required Congress to revise findings when Congress does so, when Congress revises substantive provisions of the Act. When we look specifically at the findings that are in the Affordable Care Act, the operation they describe is not the operation of the law today, whether or not the mandate is on the books. The findings in question talk about the individual mandate preventing significant adverse selection in private health insurance markets. Well, the mandate as it exists today, without any tax enforcement, will not prevent significant adverse selection. So the finding is describing a state of affairs that doesn't exist, whether or not the mandate remains on the books. In terms of the mandate itself, I think it's also important to look at the full discussion that Chief Justice Roberts provides in NFIB. In adopting the saving construction, he notes repeatedly that the mandate is not beyond the tax penalty imposing anything on private citizens. He notes that while the penalty serves to induce the purchase of health insurance, that the language of the Act need not be read to declare that failing to do so is unlawful. So under NFIB, it's not even clear that we can say that a penalty-less mandate in fact declares that someone that fails to purchase insurance is in violation of the law. All we can say is that they are subject to a tax penalty of zero. So I think that these are further elements that would make it very unlikely for a lower court, and certainly for the Supreme Court, to declare that this infirmity in exceeding the scope of the Commerce Clause requires undoing other portions of the Act that Congress has, unfortunately, repeatedly failed to undo legislatively.
So just one minor caveat to that last point about the Chief Justice said. I think it's also important to note the Chief Justice agreed with the dissent that the most straightforward, and this is his words, the most straightforward reading of the relevant section is that it commands individuals to purchase health insurance. So I think as I read his opinion, what he's saying is the dissent is correct that the best interpretation and that what Congress meant to do was mandate purchase health insurance, but I can get around it with this tax avoidance. But I think once we take the tax avoidance off the table, which I think it must be taken off the table since there is no tax penalty anymore, then the Chief Justice must just be with the dissent that, as he said, the most straightforward reading is that it commands individuals to purchase health insurance.
Yeah, I agree that he thinks that's the most straightforward reading, but I don't think that the elimination of the penalty under the Chief Justice's logic, which I've certainly criticized elsewhere, and I certainly was not persuaded by it. So I think we agree that the Chief Justice's opinion in NFIB has its problems, but taking it on its own terms, he says, and I'll just quote, while the individual mandate clearly aims to induce the purchase of health insurance, it need not be read to declare that failing to do so is unlawful. Neither the Act nor any other law attaches negative legal consequences to not buying health insurance beyond requiring a payment to the IRS. So all that's happened now is we cross out that beyond requiring a payment to the IRS, it is in effect a hortatory statement. It is a statement in the U.S. Code, of which unfortunately there are many, that purports to tell people to do something that the federal government lacks the authority to do. And it's not the only provision in the U.S. Code like that. And quite difficult to try and leverage that into trying to undo substantive provisions of the Act that are enforced, that are clearly within Congress's Commerce Clause powers, at least as they've been understood for the last 50 or so years, or 70 or so years, and to have those taken off the books, especially when Congress has tried to undo some of those provisions and has failed to do so, and has instead adopted changes to the law that produce a law that operates quite differently than the one that was originally enacted, and that will operate quite differently from the original law, whether or not the specific lines in the U.S. Code that purport to require people to purchase health insurance remain on the books or not.
Thank you, caller, for that question and for the discussion. Looks like we do have one more question. Let's go ahead and move to the caller.
Hello, my name is John Tuttle. I have a question. It relates to, I guess, the court's reluctance to do away with the Affordable Care Act. Because whenever I think of these cases, I think of the Zubik v. Burwell case, where the Supreme Court ended up just punting it back down to the lower courts. And I'm just curious, do any of you see any means by which the court could punt this case? If it came down to it, and they either just didn't have the votes for a clear opinion one way or the other, or they just didn't want to take the step that Mr. Solicitor General deems, and I somewhat agree with, that they have to invalidate it. Is there any way out for them other than a full decision? Thank you.
I'll just start. I think there are lots of ways out. I mean, first of all, I'm not. Unless the states are successful in the Fifth Circuit, I would not expect this case to go to the Supreme Court. That is to say, the only way the Supreme Court accepts cert on this case is if portions of the law beyond declaratory judgment about the mandate itself are struck down. In terms of ways out, I mean, standing certainly would be a way out. I think the court could say that while the existence of the Affordable Care Act has changed the number of people that, for example, enroll in Medicaid, it's not clear whether or not that's out of a sense of legal obligation or because of additional information about the availability of insurance, and it's also not clear whether or not those people would unenroll or stop enrolling were the law to be changed. The court could dial back on the so-called special solicitude that states are given in standing analysis anyway, which I would not be surprised if some members of the court have second thoughts about that wrinkle in standing doctrine to begin with. I think the court could say that a declaratory judgment by itself is not clearly redressable in this context as another way of avoiding it on standing. I think the court could also simply say that all there is to do in this case is to repeat that Congress cannot require someone to purchase insurance, and that unless and until there is a tax penalty, there is no harm no one is under any obligation, and any constitutional defect is cured in that way. I think those are all potential outcomes, and I would suggest that any of them are more likely outcomes than the court using this case to try and uproot some of the substantive provisions of the Affordable Care Act that remain on the books.
Yeah, I mean, I do think that standing is the way that one could try to avoid. You know, I think we saw in some of the early cases about same-sex marriage the way the court used certain standing doctrines to avoid making decisions. And there were obviously some interesting lineups in those standing decisions. And of course, standing seems to kind of come and go in various contexts. So I think that since standing doctrine is so kind of loosey-goosey and has so many different avenues, I think that if a court didn't want to decide the merits of our case, whether that court be the Supreme Court or a different court, standing doctrine has a lot of wiggle room in it.
Let me just add one other thing, just as a descriptive or a predictive matter. And I have a piece in, I guess, the Cardozo Law Review that talks about this with regard to the Chief Justice in particular. The current court and the Chief Justice in particular have become very adept at finding ways of reducing the fallout or the practical implications of its decisions. I've referred to this as anti-disruption statutory interpretation, that the Chief Justice in particular has pushed the court to adopt various approaches to statutory interpretation that minimize disruptive impact. I think you see that in the court's efforts to find saving constructions when statutes are challenged on constitutional grounds, as we saw in NFIB, as we saw in cases like United States versus Bond involving the Chemical Weapons Convention Implementation Act. We also see it in cases like King versus Burwell, where I think it's pretty clear that the Chief Justice was driven in part by a concern that following the plain text of the statute would lead to significant disruption in insurance markets in multiple states. So there may be things that neither of us have even thought of yet, ways for the court to find a way to address the underlying claims in a way that minimizes the practical fallout. I've been critical of this approach to statutory interpretation. I think it misconceives the judicial role, but I do think it, as a descriptive matter, it is certainly the case that this court has tried to find ways of ruling on cases in ways that don't upend settled expectations or disrupt complex regulatory and administrative schemes that Congress has adopted. And whether we like it or not, I think that impulse would certainly come into play in a case like this if the court were forced to deal with the merits.
Yeah, I think those are some very very smart points, and I think Professor Adler's analysis of the court's direction on these things is largely correct. I mean, I think in the hope that those kind of speculations about what the court would or wouldn't do to avoid the issues wouldn't really play into what lower courts decide. The lower courts will just decide this based upon the law, whether the Supreme Court is. When this case gets there, as currently composed or differently composed, I think will be a matter for that court. But I think just applying principles of law and current Supreme Court precedent would be how I would hope that the district court and the Fifth Circuit will decide this case.
Thank you for that question, caller, and for the discussion. It looks like we're at the end of our hour. So just want to ask, Mr. Solicitor General, do you have any closing remarks for us?
No, just thank you so much for having this call, and thank you to Professor Adler for voicing his very articulate objections to our lawsuit. He's been on the other side of this kind of thing when he was one of the thought leaders in the King versus Burwell case, and having these kinds of discussions with very intelligent people who disagree certainly helps those of us litigating sharpen our arguments to at least at best try to address them, since the judges who will be hearing our case might have the same objections, or at least might have some of the same concerns.
And Professor Adler, do you have any comments before we close the call today?
Yeah, well, just one closing thought. Whatever happens in this case, I think it's important to recognize that the Affordable Care, there are many aspects or features of the Affordable Care Act that have guaranteed a continuing litigation for years. And this would have been true whether or not the president, Donald Trump was elected president, Hillary Clinton was elected president, or anyone else. As I've written in a couple of articles, the way the law was enacted, the way it was written, and the way it operates are guaranteed to provoke both political and legal conflict. And whatever happens with this particular case, for people that are interested in the Affordable Care Act, you should be rest assured that this is not the last of Affordable Care Act-related litigation. The statute is a litigation generation machine and will be so long as it remains on the books. And whether or not that's good or bad may depend on one's view of Affordable Care Act or whether one's benefiting from the work it generates. But we should recognize that this sort of statute is the sort of thing that produces this sort of legal conflict, and that might be the sort of thing that Congress should consider in the future when it thinks about the sorts of reforms it wants to make either in this industry or other similarly complex industries.
Wonderful. Well, on behalf of the Federalist Society, I would like to thank our speakers today for the benefit of their valuable time and expertise. We welcome all listener feedback by email at info@fedsoc.org. Thank you all for joining us today. This call is now adjourned.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.